It's really just incredible subject matter. This morning's topic actually was something that I know less about. I knew less about and know less about than I did our first two subjects and our fourth subject. But one, the more that I read it, the more that I look into it, the more, you know, if we're going to have a Mount Rushmore of founding Zionist fathers, founding fathers of the State of Israel, you make a very good case that Weizmann is our George Washington. And Weizmann belongs at the very top. Not because he had the tenacity, not because he had, you know, he did very different things than Ben-Gurion. We didn't even, you know, Ben-Gurion, we didn't really get past World War I last week. But the amount that Ben-Gurion did leading up to the Hakamat HaMdina and then stewarding it in those early years was astronomical. There's a very strong argument to be made that without Weizmann, we never would have gotten anywhere within a shouting distance of Hakamat HaMdina come the 1940s. As we're going to see tonight, Weizmann was the chief architect of the 1917 Balfour Declaration that was happening in mid-World War I. And that is really what kick-started international recognition for political Zionism, and which is what, without that, there never would have been Hakamat HaMdina. So before we get started, let me just, I like to do my weekly reference point of showing you guys what I consulted. So the most important thing that I consulted with, there hasn't been a biography written of Weizmann since the 1980s. This was published in 1986 by a guy named Norman Rose. Of the biographies that I've read, that I've been using so far, I would put this on the bottom. It's not so well written. It's not so well documented, which is frustrating when you're trying to use it as a source material. But it does tell a decent story of his life. I got through most of it. It's a little bit confusing because this was written at the height of the Soviet Union. So it actually refers to a lot of the countries that we're trying to refer to. You know, today, you know, he lived in the Pale of Settlement, but today it's known as the Belarusian Republic of the Soviet, you know, Soviet Socialist Republics or something like that. So it's a little confusing like that. There's also no images or anything like that, so it's just words. So if you need a picture book, it's not such a great one. But at the moment, this is the best that we got. I am assuming this is Weizmann would be a really good subject for a historian to write a full monograph on. I'm not sure why it hasn't happened in recent years, but This is the best one I got. So this is a definitely very valuable resource. For lack of anything else, I would definitely recommend it. Let me show you. Okay, so the other probably even more important of a source, but you'll understand why. This is a Chaim Weizmann's autobiography, known as Trial and Error. This was not signed by Weizmann or anything, but this has been out of print for 20, 30 years. So I had to buy I bought this years ago, but I bought a used copy. It's called Trial and Error. It's Weizmann's memoirs that he wrote at the end of his life. Very, very important historical source. Of course, autobiography, as done as a recollection when he's recalling events that happened 60, 70 years earlier, is always have to be done with a grain of salt. It's not a contemporaneous account, but at the same time, this is Weizmann himself, and he tells stories, and he goes through chronologically all the different dates. This is a very important one. Okay, so then just a couple of extra side ones. So the Shapira biography of Ben-Gurion, which we referred to when we were doing Ben-Gurion last year. Ben-Gurion and Weizmann come the 1930s, were very, mid-1920s, 20s and 30s, they were very, very, very involved with one another. 40s, not as much, but they were still they were partners. They were the world's two chief Zionist leaders. So there's a lot of important material in any good Ben-Gurion biography. These are two. I've used both of these in the past. These are two collections of primary sources that have to do with Zionism. This is actually from the Hakamat HaMdina, this is really founding Zionists going through the Hakamat HaMdina. This actually is the origin starting from the first Aliyah in the 1880s through 1948, through the Hakamat HaMdina. This is also very important stuff. The only thing for Weizmann in here was something that he wrote in favor of the founding of the Hebrew University, which we will get to. This has about three or four essays spanning a much wider period of time. These are also very important. Okay, the last thing that I'll give you, as we're going to see, Weizmann's main political activity really started at the beginning of World War I in 1914, and it went through. He was the man until the 1940s, and he was essential to the Zionist cause. This is a book I picked it up. I haven't been able to read through cover to cover, but using the index, I got a number of pieces about Weizmann from him. This is a book that's actually about the Jewish underground that existed, right, with Begin and Jabotinsky, the Irgun Tzva'i Lumi, Lochamei Chirut Yisrael, Esel and Lechi. This is actually a monograph just about the underground during those years. Weizmann was, very, very involved. We're probably not going to get to it tonight because we're probably not going to get past World War I again. But if we ever do part two, Weizmann was a very, very active player in the repressing of the underground. So there's a lot of material in here. Anonymous Soldiers, The Struggle for Israel, 1917. This is written very, very well. You have it?
Who wrote that?
This is written by Bruce Hoffman.
You say he was involved in repressing the underground?
Yes. We'll get to it. We'll get by a show of hands, who's going to be here on Shavuos? Right. Okay, so most of you are going to be here. So we're going to have part four of the lecture. We're going to do Begin. We're going to be doing it the first day of Shavuos in the afternoon, an hour before Mincha. I had a request from a few people to on Shavuos. So I'm sorry if you're not going to be here. I'll send you whatever material we have. But it was a request, and I'm running out of time. And it's not on the flyer, but we're going to add one more, at least one more, possibly two more, but we're definitely going to add one more in a couple of weeks after Yontif. It's going to be, my plan right now is to do Golda Meir. If anybody has any interests other than Golda, let me know. But my plan is to do Golda, and then if we have one more, I'm deciding between a few different people. But I'm trying to do people that were very active pre the Hakamat HaMedina, and not in the case of Jabotinsky, but in the case of Ben Gurion and Weizmann, and Begin were very active post Hakamat HaMedina. So Golda definitely fits that bill as well. So we're gonna do her as well. So that's that. So Weizmann, who is Weizmann? Weizmann is the most important character in the founding Zionist ideology and the history of Zionism that we don't know much about. He was, many people, usually if you ask people, the most that they'll know is that he was the first president of the State of Israel, which is 100% true, and probably what he's most known for, but at the same time, the presidency, as I'm sure we all know, the presidency is mostly an honorary position in the State of Israel. The presidency was created for diplomatic purposes, for ceremonial purposes, but not for governmental, legislative, decision-making type of purposes. That was not what the presidency was. I don't know this because I know it in terms of the founding, the forming of the government, but I guess I've always thought, without having actually researched this inside, the presidency was kind of catered to a person like Weizmann. They needed, it was inconceivable after all of his efforts for the Hakamat, that led to the Hakamat HaMedina, it was inconceivable that he wasn't going to play a central role in the government. He was alive for the last 3 years, for his last 3 years on Olam Hazeh, where he saw the Hakamat HaMedina. So it was inconceivable that somebody like Weizmann wasn't going to be involved in the founding government of the State of Israel. But he didn't have it in him. He was already an old 70s, he was very sick, and he couldn't be a statesman, he couldn't be making decisions, he didn't have the wherewithal to do that anymore. And I guess, again, I have to research the presidency, but I haven't really yet, but I guess I've always thought that this is exactly the type of thing that's made for somebody like that, an elder statesman who has the reverence and respect of the entire country. That's the person that let the president. That's the person that greets foreign dignitaries. That's the person that is in charge of decorum in the Knesset. He's the one who appoints the head of the leading party in the elections to form a government. Kind of serving quasi many of the roles that the monarch serves in the British monarchy, basically the directing things, but not really having a direct say in how they go. Right? And if you think about it, that's exactly why it makes perfect sense that Shimon Peres was also the president in the at the end of his life. Because he, even though he was a very controversial figure throughout his career, people as many people hated him as liked him, and even the people that liked him didn't even like him so much for a long period, but he was the elder statesman with a long resume of service for the Medinat Yisrael, and Peres was the natural choice. That's exactly, in our modern in our modern model, that's exactly who Weizmann was, the founding president of the State of Israel. But who was he? What did he achieve such renown? Why was this person who was essentially somebody who lived in Galut his entire life, unlike Ben Gurion, unlike Jabotinsky, unlike Begin, who spent decades before the Hakamat HaMedina in Ottoman or British Palestine? Why is it that Weizmann, who spent most of his life in Galut, why was he somebody that was the uncontested, unquestionable choice for president of the State of Israel? And that's what we'd like to discuss this morning. So who was Chaim Weizmann? Chaim Weizmann was born in 1874 in the city of Muttel. Okay, so I have over here, Muttel. It's in what is today Belarus, if you look on the back page. Okay, and Muttel is about what is it? It's a little bit northwest of Pinsk. About 30 miles northwest of Pinsk. So he lived the typical, like Ben-Gurion, and like we'll see Bezrat Hashem over Yantif, like we'll see with Begin, Weizmann lived the typical shtetl life that existed in the Pale of Settlement. And the more of these characters that you see, and the more that you read and learn about the Pale of Settlement, the more that you see that it was the anti-Semitism already dating back to the 18th century in Catherine the Great's court that shoved all the Jews into the Pale of Settlement, into this unsettled land that nobody wanted because they didn't want them there. It is that anti-Semitism that really gave birth to what we, you know, what was the generation that our grandparents all grew up in. The generation of the European shtetl that fostered a Jewish culture, that fostered Jewish learning, that gave birth to not only, you know, towering poetry and authors that happened already in the 19th century, but also to the great Torah tradition that began there. The reason why Lithuania and Poland were able to be such Torah centers come the 19th century in places like Volozhin was because the Tsarist Russian regime forced all the Jews into this place, and they actually lived a relatively insular life. It was an unintended consequence of the anti-Semitism of the 18th and 19th centuries. So typical life, the same way right out of Fiddler on the Roof. He lived in a town Muttel actually had a majority of Gentile population, but it was a small place with hundreds of Jewish families, a rich Jewish life. Weizmann went to Cheder, went to yeshiva growing up. He was a bright guy. His father was, and we'll jump right into it. His father was actually the part of the family and the part of his upbringing that makes things unique, makes things different, and actually probably is what laid the groundwork for him to be who he was as time went on. Even though Muttel was a typical shtetl, so his father, Ozer Weizmann, born in 18, is the first picture on the page, by the way, whoever suggested that I put captions on the stuff that I put in here from last week, so I obliged and I did it. Took a little extra time, but I tried. So the first picture over here, Ozer Weizmann, born in 1850. He marries Rachel Leah Weizmann, 1852. So they have, between the two of them, they have 15 children. So that is something else. And what is even more shocking than 15 kids is that 12 of them actually survived to adulthood. So in that era in human history, that didn't happen very often. So Weizmann came from a very big, very tightly knit family. And unlike Ben-Gurion, and unlike Jabotinsky, he never really had a break with his family. Which is actually pretty significant. Because the animosity that we see in a lot of the founding people, you know, the founding fathers of the state of Israel, whether we're talking about Levi Eshkol, whether we're talking about Ben-Gurion, whether we're talking about even Yitzhak Rabin, whose father was grew up religious, we're talking, even Begin to some extent, we're talking about these people. There was never a break with Weizmann from his home. He always got along with everyone. His father was a lovely, special, congenial man. He spoke reverently of his father his entire life, and his father actually lived a relatively long life. He only died in 1911. We saw with both Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion, they lost a parent at a very early age, and his parents lived, his father, till 1911, so you do the math how old he was, and he was already very much an adult. He was in his 40s, and his mother already died in 1939, so it was only 12 years before Weizmann died. So he had his parents around, and he had this big family. The other thing that's very, very unique to the Weizmann family, before we know anything about them, is that Weizmann was one of nine of the children of the Weizmanns, of Ozer and Rachel Leah Weizmann, that had a university degree. That, in the shtetl, was almost unheard of. And so why was this? Because Ozer was your very typical shtetl Jew. He was somebody who learned Torah and lived Torah. Weizmann writes about him in his autobiography about how he was the type of person that had paragraphs of the Shulchan Aruch constantly coming out of his mouth. He was always talking about Torah. He always wanted to learn. In one piece of the autobiography, it's beautiful, he describes what Friday night was like in his house growing up. His father, who was a wood merchant, all right, we'll discuss in a second. His father was a wood merchant. He would come home almost every Shabbos. He would very rarely was away for Shabbos. His father would come home and he would be completely gassed from his week. He would come home from shul. They would sit down. They would have a little bit of soup and a piece of chicken, and then he would go take a quick nap for about 15 minutes, a little power nap, and then he would come back to the dining room, and everybody in the family would pull out something to read or something to learn. And it was like reading hour in the Weitzman family. So this was somebody who actually fostered the Weitzman's parents were people that fostered a sense of inquisitiveness, a sense of scholarship, a sense of learning. And what was unique, not only in the sense that they promoted secular education, was that he was very much a maskil. That the Weitzman actually refers to him as a maskil, somebody who is a member of the Haskalah, somebody who fully embraced the idea that worldly knowledge was something that was something for us to imbibe, something for us to absorb. And because of that, Weitzman, who, although he grew up in a very, very traditional home and went to yeshiva for the first 11 years of his life, exclusively yeshiva, and then yeshiva and other things we'll see in a second, he was somebody that grew up in a home that was traditional. And because, I guess this is, in our own contemporary times, I guess this is one of the many arguments for modern orthodoxy, is the way that we let in a certain amount of the general culture and the world around us, so that our children will get all of the best that they can from the world around us. But at the same time, we still cling to tradition, and we're very selective. We're very selective, depending on who you are. You're selective to some degree, but how much you're going to let in. So that was Weitzman's home, right? We could in today's vernacular, and of course he didn't speak this way, but we probably could call Weitzman growing up in a modern Orthodox home, in today's terminology. So born in 1874. Chaim Azriel Weitzman, born to Ozer and Rachelea. It's now Southwest Belarus. He was the third of five boys and seven girls, right? Another three died in infancy. 1879 to 1882. His father, we said, was very, very busy. So another one of the important relationships that he had growing up, Weitzman, was with his grandparents. And if his father was a traditional Jew, his grandfather was somebody who was the guy with the kapata and the longa beard and the payas. So he spoke glowingly of his grandparents. And although he didn't experience the death of a parent in childhood, he actually did recall for the rest of his life the trauma that he experienced as an 11-year-old when his grandfather died. So he was somebody that was steeped in tradition. Again, you can't forget about this. You can't ignore this. So was Levi Eshkol. So was David Ben Gurion. So was Menachem Begin. So were many of the founders. But the break that they all had, the casting away of their upbringing, is something that Weitzman, to some degree, he ended up not being a religious and not being an observant man. But he always spoke lovingly and fondly of religion. And as he takes up Achad Ha'am's ideology of a cultural Judaism, it's a break from religion, but in many ways it's connected as well. Okay, well, which we'll see again in a second. Okay, so 1879 to 1882. So you'll see he's a young boy. That's when he lives with his grandfather, because his father was had this business. So what was his father's business? If you look on the map, so Muttal was over here. So he had a lumber, a timber business. So it was seasonal. He would employ a whole bunch of people to cut down timber in a wooded area where in Muttal was, and then he would fill up these shipments, and then he would basically oversee shipments all the way to Danzig, which is I didn't mark it off, but Danzig is all the way here on the coast of the sea in Lithuania. So it was a very, very painstaking process, and it meant that he was away from home a lot. So because of that, Weitzman, for this long period of time, actually lived with his grandparents, who lived next door. But that's when he developed that relationship as well. Okay, so the first step in Weitzman, and you see the picture over here, is Weitzman as a child. So the first step in Weitzman's career, in which his first step outside of the shtetl, is when he left home to go to Pinsk. He left home to go to Pinsk as an 11-year-old, and he went to go to attend gymnasium. His parents actually, like I said, very much did value his secular education. They believed in it. They were card-carrying members of the Haskalah, and they believed in all those things. The type of maskilic literature that was found, and not without argument and strife among different religious communities, that was found and was regularly read in the home of Weitzman. This is a picture of him as a kid. Okay. So this is actually a striking, I'm going to refer to source number one in the middle. Again, the blue boxes are actual sources. So source number one in the middle is a striking thing, not just for what he actually says, but the fact that he's 11 years old when he says it. This is 1885. Everybody with me, source number one. Do not imagine that when I attend the gymnasium, and this is as he's about to leave the gymnasium, he's writing to one of his teachers, one of his rabbeim from Muttal, when he's about to leave. Do not imagine that When I attend the gymnasium, that I will throw off, it's supposed to say, off the garb of Judaism. No, on no account. I have determined in my heart to observe Judaism, and I shall oppose the opinion of those who say that one becomes a doctor because he casts off his faith. I am sending you one of my ideas, and that concerns Chevrat Chovevei Tzion and Yerushalayim, which is in our land. Let us carry our banner to Tzion. He's writing this right when he gets to Pinsk. In Pinsk, there was a very active Chovevei Tzion. Chovevei Tzion is important. It's important to know what Chovevei Tzion was and when it sprouted. It sprouted in 1882 with the rise of the pogroms in the Pale of Settlement. That's when Chovevei Tzion. That was when the first movements. Again, this is 14 years before Herzl publishes their Judenstadt. The Chovevei Tzion were the first ones to say the solution to all of this is for everybody to pick up and go. But they didn't have an organized political movement the way Herzl had it set up. The Chovevei Tzion were really just about facts on the ground, go, pick up, everybody just pack your suitcase and go. So they were already reestablishing settlements in the 1880s. So he ran into this Chovevei Tzion movement. We're in the second paragraph after the second two dots. Let us carry our banner to Tzion and return to our first mother upon whose knees we were born. For why should we look to the kings of Europe for compassion, that they should take pity upon us and give us a resting place? In vain, all have decided the Jews must die, but England will nevertheless have mercy upon us. In conclusion, to Tzion, Jews, to Tzion, let us go. This is an 11-year-old writing. Now, I think that it's probably most likely that he sat in some type of Chovevei Tzion meeting in some shul somewhere, and he was just repeating what the type of things that they were saying. I mean, we know 11-year-olds. 11-year-olds don't write like this. I mean, this is a translation, obviously, from the Russian, but no, not Russian. It's a translation from the Yiddish. But nevertheless, this is the fact that, it's already a step, even that he got to the point of repeating this letter while he was at boarding in Pinsk, 30, 40 miles from home, and writing this, not only to reaffirm his faith, but also to declare his love and passion for Zionism. So, I guess the psychologists in the room, so you'll say that this is already something, the seeds have already been laid, been set from a very early age, that he's going to be an ardent Zionist. Okay, so he goes to Pinsk in 1885. He boarded with a Jewish family, along with his brother Feivel, who comes with him. So when he actually goes to Pinsk, he goes with a sibling. But when visiting, and he would go and he would visit home. Whenever he would visit home, and again, this is a mark of how precocious in general he was, but specifically when it came to Zionism. In 1886, he's visiting home. He's a 12-year-old. He would lecture the young kids in Motul about Chovevei Tzion. So apparently he would attend these Chovevei Tzion meetings in Pinsk as a 12-year-old, as an 11-year-old. And he would lead the kids. He didn't do it. He didn't lead them. But already Weizmann, as a 12-year-old, got a whole bunch of kids to start a Zionist youth group. Right? The equivalent of a Snif Bnei Akiva that we would see today. The first one, the first of its kind in Motul. And he was the spearhead behind it. Take a look at source number two. Source number two is a description of Chana Weizmann, Weizmann's older sister. It's his younger sister, describing what it was like for Weizmann's visit home. And the reason why I included this is because this is instructive, not only of his passions and zeal. This is instructive. This source at a very, very early stage of the type of personality that he had. One of the things that is so significant about Weizmann is the fact that he was such a congenial person. People liked him. He was always good in conversation. Everybody would meet him, and everybody liked him. I forgot the book, the one book that I forgot, I was using it a lot at home, I didn't bring it this morning, is David McCullough's biography of Harry Truman. I don't know if anybody is a David McCullough fan. I'm a huge McCullough fan. So he has this 900-page biography of Harry Truman. There's about 20, 30 pages in there about Truman's role in the Hakamat HaMedina. Essential reading, but obviously it's a part of a much larger biography of Truman. So I would definitely add that. I mentioned that because the same way, we're not going to get to the 1940s, but I will tease to the story a little bit. The fact that he was able to get Harry Truman was a little bit of a crass person, right? He was also the most powerful man in the world in the 1940s. The fact that he was able to have an audience with Harry Truman and have Truman immediately like him, to the point that years later, when he needed his support for the November 29th partition vote, 1947, the fact that he was so congenial, right? This is where diplomacy is made. Diplomacy actually can be made between two nice people who it's very important that they like each other. And if they don't like each other, then bad stuff can happen. And that it's crazy that things depend on that, but that is in fact the case. Weizmann was a nice, good guy. Let's see number two. This is a letter from 1890. So Weizmann here, in 1890, he's 16 years old. It was a festival for all of us, and for almost all the people of the town who regarded him as their favorite. Again, this is referring to Chaim Weizmann. At home and in the homes of the uncles and the rest of the relatives, there were great preparations for his coming. For Chaim in his youth was known for great wit, was lighthearted and happy, would artistically tell humorous stories, mimic every preacher and every rabbi, and everywhere he went, he was the spirit of life. Alright, this is his sister describing how everybody, he was a magnetic personality, he was funny, he was cute, he knew how to, you know, poke fun at the rabbi, he knew how to poke fun at people and, you know, imitate their voices, and everybody liked him. He knew how to make people laugh, he knew how to make people feel comfortable and have a good time. And that made him, that was an essential component of what made him such an important statesman. Okay. So he lives in Pinsk for a number of years. That's actually in his gymnasium, in his primary school years in Pinsk. That's when he first develops a love for chemistry. He becomes a chemist, which is extremely important. I'll make this point now. It's pretty unique in terms of the founding Zionistic ideologues that he is a doctor. He is a, you know, has a doctorate and is an educated and, you know, very, very educated person. But he's not somebody who is what we would say is, you know, the higher sciences of philosophy, of political science, of history. He was somebody that actually had, right, what we would like to joke around in my doctoral program as a real job, as opposed to, you know, the PhDs who are teaching in school and are saying, you know, what are the, or, forgive me for all the PhDs in the room, right, but that's the, you know, that's the big joke with college professors. And Weizmann actually had a little bit of an inferiority complex about this. He thought that the people who were PhDs who were doing all the highfalutin political scientific thinking, all right, about theories about Zionism, theories about how a polity and a government should be built, he actually felt a little bit of an inferiority thing with them, because all he knew how to do was be a chemist. In the end, his skills about having being a chemist probably were much more important, again, as we will see. So he first gets into chemistry as a young man while in a gymnasium in Pinsk. 1888, so he, again, remember, he's there with his brother Feivel. His father, Ozer, is unable to support his son's living away. So Feivel returns home to help with the family business, and he leaves Weizmann, who tutors the son of a wealthy Jewish man from Pinsk. So 1888, again, he's 14 years old at 1888. This is already the point where he starts to teach. So I'm going to speak from personal experience, not because my life is in any way even remotely comparable, but on this particular point, I can speak with some experience. My father, because of the unique type of shul that we were in, my father had me teaching at a very early age, and it was something standing in front of a group of people and giving over information and trying to, you know, being sensitive to what works and what doesn't work. What do people like, what don't people like. It's something that I started to work at a very early age. Communication is a very big part of teaching. The fact, I didn't see any of the biographers or anybody say this, but I was reading this and that it jumped out at me, I guess because of my, you know, because of my own personal experience. The fact that Weizmann was a teacher, an actual teacher, and a tutor, and in charge of making people understand things at a very early age, I think is another very formative experience. From a very, very early age, right? He's only 14, 15 years old, he's tutoring kids, he's teaching classes, and it's his job to impart information and impart passion about that information to other people. Something which is, again, a mark of his diplomacy and a mark of his career that happened and that we saw for the rest of his life. Okay, we're on page 2 now. 1892, in August, he graduates from the gymnasium in Pinsk. So the decision that happened with any Jewish graduate from gymnasium in Pinsk, so usually you were able to go to school, but anybody who wanted to go, you know, move on in their education. So the big question, the tantalizing question for every Jew at this period in history was whether or not you try and fudge papers, because technically Jews were barred from higher education in the Pale of Settlement. So whether you would go to a place like Warsaw or a place like Odessa and go to school in the Pale of Settlement and just try and fudge the papers, pretend you're not Jewish, try and finagle your way in by some other way, or to go to Western Europe. So that's a big shell shock for somebody who grows up in the shtetl to go to Western Europe. But those were the people that wanted to pursue higher education. Those were the two avenues that they did. And by the way, there's countless examples of people that we know. Some of the biggest players on the Jewish scene in the 20th century were shtetl dwellers, were born and raised in the shtetl, and made this decision to go to Western Europe for higher education and ended up staying. Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg, The Street of Ashes, is another very good example of that. If anybody's interested, you should read Mark Shapiro's biography of Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg. It's magnificent. And it gets to this whole idea, and he really does a very, very good treatment of what it was like for somebody to grow up in the shtetl and then have the shell shock of moving to Western Europe. So Weizmann, like Yaakov Weimer, right? Weizmann makes the decision, like so many did in his generation, to actually go west. So he decides to go. So he decides to go west, and he moves from Pinsk. Right, he stops at home, and then he moves from Pinsk in the summer of 1892. He moves to Germany. So he enrolls right around 1892 in September. He enrolls in the Polytechnic Institute in Darmstadt, Germany. It's 20 miles south of Frankfurt. So if you want to look at the map, you'll see where it is. So this is pretty far from home. He starts off in Muckel, and he ends up going to Darmstadt. Right, that's a half a world away. He has to pass through like six languages in order to get there. He didn't really speak German. He actually didn't learn Russian until later in life because he was reared in a home that only spoke Yiddish. So he did not have the gift of languages that, like we were talking about, that Vladimir Jabotinsky had. Jabotinsky was somebody who not only had a natural gift for languages, but somebody who had lived in a city in which all these different languages were being yapped at him, and he was armed from the day that he left home with several languages. So this was not just for language purposes, but it was a big shell shock for Weizmann to go to Germany. And it actually turns out his first year in Germany doesn't work out so well. So he goes in 1892, and already after 1 year, he decides that he was overworked, deeply turned off. He was lonely. He never really had too many friends. And what is actually very interesting, what he writes about in his memoirs, is the other thing that was a big turnoff in Darmstadt, that he was in his first university experience, was his first encounter with assimilated Jews. And he didn't know what to do. He didn't understand the idea of a Jew who's openly and proudly Jewish, but didn't... it's not a question of belief. It wasn't really about faith. He didn't understand how there's such a rich culture to Jewish life. He doesn't understand how people didn't embrace it, didn't pursue it, what wasn't of interest to them. And an 18-year-old yeshiva kid who goes to a secular college for the first time. It's a big shell shock. Excuse me. So as a result, he's miserable after his first year. And in the summer of 1893, he returns home, and for all those reasons. So he writes about this. He spends the summer at home. He writes in his memoirs, this is like funny stuff. He got so into cricket while he was in Berlin, while he was in Darmstadt for that year, that he insists that he had a big family. He insists on teaching all of his siblings cricket. So he writes about this. I don't know why this was such an important recollection for him, but I guess it was a warm memory of his home that, again, he's gone a year and then he comes back and, you know, he doesn't miss a beat. It's just, again, a testament to the fact that he never really broke with his family the way some of the other founding fathers of the State of Israel did. So he spent the summer playing cricket, and then he decides in 1893, in September, after the summer, to go back to Germany, and he returns west, and he attends Charlottenburg Polytechnic in Berlin. So he goes to Berlin, and that Berlin is where he really matures and comes into himself. Berlin is a place with a vibrant Jewish community, a vibrant even religious Jewish community. If anybody was in Mincha Maariv this past week, one or two of you were, definitely I remember. So we were talking about the tshuva that we read about Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, the Malamed Lahoil, who is the Rosh Yeshiva in Berlin of the Hildesheimer Yeshiva. The Hildesheimer Yeshiva was a world-renowned, you know, a world-class, first-rate yeshiva in Germany. There was a very, very strong Orthodox presence, and because of that, all right, because of that, and among other things, there was the whole intelligentsia that surrounded Berlin at that period in time was very rich. So that, and the fact that he found a group of friends, he found a group of Russian Jewish students. This was a big part of university life in Western Europe in that era. There was always a lot of exchange students. There was always people from other things. So there was the days before Hillel. So there was a natural coming together of other Russian kids from the shtetl, and he ends up becoming a part of that group, and he's happy. Okay, so he's there for 2 years in Berlin. In June of 1895, he returns to his family for a full year. He takes a year off. So this is now, he's done 3 years of university, for the first one in Darmstadt, and then two in Berlin, and then in June of 1895, he returns to his family for a full year. By then, he wrote of the Pinsk, right, by the time he had spent, and this is probably what's most important, most telling, by the time he gets to home after the third year, right, the second year in Berlin, he starts talking about the Pinsk Jews as being these backwards, third world, you know, people that he's actually embarrassed of. So again, think about the age. If he leaves when he's 18, and then now he's 21, so it's, you know, you're your college senior who's spent this time away from home and now thinks that they know more than the rest of the world. And, you know, with my version of right is obviously right. And then he comes home and he sees all of this other version of Judaism that he grew up with, and he doesn't like it anymore. And he feels very, very offended by it. Okay, so let's, we'll save the source for a couple more, in one more minute, in source number 3. Okay, so he goes home for an entire year, and then in September of the following year, September of 1896, he returns to Berlin to continue his studies. He deepens a relationship he had already developed with a fellow named Leo Mutzkin, who was a future Zionist leader. Leo Mutzkin, again, we don't have enough time to get into any of this stuff, but Leo Mutzkin ends up being originally a colleague, a very important partner. He's a very important Zionist leader in the pre-state decades. There's a picture of him up top. So he becomes very close with Leo Mutzkin. They partner on a lot of things, and he becomes acquainted. And he'd stay close. He considered him a friend, even though he was about 15 years his senior. He becomes very close with Asher Tzvi Ginzburg, known as Achad HaAm. Achad HaAm was one of probably the most well-known writer of Zionist ideology. And what's very significant is that as soon as Herzl started his program, Achad HaAm, who was writing Zionist thought even before Herzl published Der Judenstaat, comes to the first Zionist Congress. Achad HaAm is appalled at the lack of culture, the lack of Jewish culture. Basically, what we would call, you know, the Tam, what we would call the Neshama of Judaism. He wasn't a religious man, but he thought Achad HaAm's whole ethos, his ideology, was that Zionism is supposed to be promoting a Jewish culture. And if there's not a Jewish culture, then all you're going to have is a bunch of people whose grandparents were Jews, and we're just going to have, and there's going to be nothing Jewish about the state. Herzl didn't really have any patience for Jewish culture. He just wanted to get the physical bodies of the Jews from Russia into what was then Ottoman Palestine. So Achad HaAm immediately speaks to him. He encounters Achad HaAm's writings, and he meets him. Achad HaAm was living in Berlin. So these are two very important acquaintances, and he ends up, there are many, many letters that Weizmann writes as he gets more involved in Zionist activity, confiding in Achad HaAm, asking advice of Achad HaAm. So very, very important relationships that he develops. 1897 in August, he leaves Berlin, following his academic mentor to the Swiss University in Freiburg, Switzerland. Freiburg is in the end where he actually gets finishes his PhD. That's when he finishes his doctorate. And that's after being there in August 1998. He spends 2 years there. And in January, a year and a half, and after a year and a half in Freiburg, January of 1899, he submitted his thesis on synthetic dyes. One of the things that he was looking in chemistry, he actually gets to chemical weaponry, later during World War I, about 15 years later. But his original research and what he was doing in these early years, and this is interesting, not that important, but he was pursuing the use of dyes in specific manufacturing. So I'm going to make a shirt, I'm going to make some sort of something that needs to get colored blue. So it used to be that you would have to dye things with natural sources. He was a chemist who was trying to produce dyes that were synthetic. And if he was able to mass produce, and it seems silly, but this is actually potentially a huge, huge financial windfall for him if he could actually develop a patent that could make manufacturing blue shirts that much easier. So he actually worked on this project for a bunch of years, not seeing so much fruit. He actually ended up writing a couple of patents, but his fame and fortune comes later for other things. Okay, so he submits his thesis on synthetic dyes in 1890. So that was in January. In April of 1899, three months later, he moves to Geneva, Switzerland. And in Geneva, that's when he secures a professorship, a university position for the first time. He starts off very low on the university totem pole. And originally, because he was this low, he actually didn't have a tenured or regular salary. He wasn't even like what we would call an adjunct salary. His salary was dependent on the number of students that he got. And in the end, he had this seminar that he was teaching. I forget what it was. It was X number of dollar, X number of marks per student that he got. He ended up having 15 students, and that number was ballooning, which is, again, a testament to the fact that I would argue his many years of teaching that he already was fostering as a young teenager paid dividends, because he not only had this passionate interest in this area of knowledge, not only had this expertise, but he was a good orator. He was able to talk, have people understand, and share and convey passion in an area that was very, very important for his communication, and also in the early stages of his career and his ability to teach. Okay, so that's where he is in 1899. He moves to Geneva, he gets this job. Okay, this is where the Zionism converges. Now, up until now, I didn't really write much about his Zionism. He was active in Pinsk in the Chovev Beit Zion, and then he was active in Berlin to some extent. The reason why Leo Mutzkin and the reason why Achad Ha'am were people that he was conversing with, people that he was spending time with, the reason why he was spending time with these young groups of Russian Jewish students in Berlin is because culturally, the big, you know, what was all the rage in the close of the 19th century was Zionism. And Herzl, right, and we all know the story. Herzl in 1896 publishes their Judenstadt, and it catches on like wildfire. And now all of a sudden, it's our, you know, the colloquial Shabbos table where we're all discussing whatever's on our mind. This was what was on the mind of European Jewry. There were many who were for it. There were many more who were against it, vehemently against it. There were people who were against it for religious reasons. There were people who were against it for what became and still is today in some circles, this fear, this crippling anxiety of dual loyalty. For some reason, it seems to be a uniquely Jewish problem. No other ethnic group in the world seems to ever be worried about a country, a host country, thinking that they are disloyal because they care about some other ethnic goal. But that was it was one of the big things. And another big reason that people opposed it was because in the revolution of socialist revolutions that were happening in the early 20th century, people thought that the way that we are going to preserve Judaism is by making Judaism synonymous with socialism, and we're just going to be like anybody else in what would become the Soviet Union, like any other good Russian. We're going to be a good Russian citizen. They've declared that religion doesn't matter anymore. It's all about this collective good. We're going to be that. Those were the Bundists. The Bundists, we spoke a little bit about that with Ben-Gurion. The Bundists were Ben-Gurion, one of Ben-Gurion's many arch enemies, and they gave the Zionists in general a lot of trouble, including Herzl. So he, in 1900, he attends the fourth Zionist Congress in London. He actually had gone to a couple of earlier ones, but in 1900 he attends the fourth Zionist Congress. Let's read source number three. This is about what he describes about his life in Berlin and how he developed. And again, we're trying to just look at the point that his development not only in terms of his coming of age, but in terms of his Zionism as well. Here in Berlin, again, this is in 1898. Here in Berlin, I grew out of my boyhood Zionism, out of my adolescence, into something like maturity. When I left Berlin for Switzerland in 1898, at the age of 24, the adult pattern of my life was set. Of course, I learned a great deal in later years, but no fundamental change took place. My Zionist ideology, my scientific bent, my life's purpose had crystallized. So when I say that he met people like Mutzkin, he met people like Achad Ha'am, not coincidentally, at the time that we all do this, right? Like most developing human beings do, they kind of figure out who they are and who they want to be in those early 20s. It's right around when we're graduating college, right? And in our community, at least, when we're the time that we're trying to find somebody to marry, right? Those are the decisions that we're making in this period in life, because this is the point developmentally where you really reach adulthood. Your brain is still, neurologically speaking, your brain is still developing until around the age 24, 25. So it would make sense. You see, for famous people that we read their memoirs throughout world history will make comments like this around this age. But for Weizmann, this is the time that his Zionism it grew out of the coming home from Pinsk, from grade school in Pinsk, and lecturing to the Bnei Akiva Sniff, right, Ki'ilu, in the local shul in Muttal, and it turned into an actual ideology. Something that, again, coming from Achad Ha'am, coming from people like Mutzkin. This idea of Zionism, but also Zionism also representing something that representing this ideal for Jews not only to be saved and placed, situated in the land of Israel, but also to have this Jewish culture, Achad Ha'am's ideology. Okay, so we get to 1900 and he attends the fourth Zionist Congress in London, England. The first three were in Basel, right, 1897, 1898, 1899. And then in the summer, they were in the summer every year. So in the summer of 1900 is the fourth Zionist Congress. Herzl tries to change it up a little bit, and then they go to London. So he is a delegate at the fourth Zionist Congress, and he actually gets up and gives a speech. I don't know how much we know about the Zionist Congresses. I mentioned a little bit about it in Jabotinsky. So it was basically a conference where there was a host of the conference, which in the first 6 years were Herzl, right, the chairman of the conference. They would get up and they would set an agenda. They would call things for a vote, delegates would vote, but then delegates would have an opportunity to get up and speak on whatever issues they were at. It was kind of like a government without a land that was actually being governed. Anybody who says Anybody who, you know, who talks about how the Zionists, at their early stages leading up to the Hakamat HaMedina, actually had government institutions in place. It's not just because they were making settlements, and it's not just because they had the Jewish agency in the land of Israel. They also had this governing body for 50 years already, in which it was extremely organized and it was extremely well run. This was the political activism that was going on in the Zionist Congress. So in 1900, he attends the Zionist Congress as a delegate, and he gets up and gives a speech. Number four. I should preface this. Number four, he gets up and he gives a speech. At the fourth Zionist Congress, that's the time that Mizrahi basically had their coming out party. Right, Mizrahi was a part already from the first Zionist Congress 3 years earlier, but Mizrahi, led by Rabbi Yehuda Leib Reines, I'm pretty sure I got his first names right. Right. He led by Rav Reines, who was the leader of the Mizrahi, which were the religious Zionists. So Rav Reines got up and he insisted to Herzl that all issues in terms of education in the new state, in terms of the Zionist goals, they should be left to the Mizrahi. And there's echoes of this today. This is actually something that's still of today. The religious parties that still exist in the Knesset, the only thing that they want to be in charge of, the only thing that they want jurisdiction over is really their own education, but in the early years leading up to the state, they wanted to define the ethos of the state by being put in charge of the education. And for people like Herzl, who didn't care about education, and culture of the state didn't really matter to him, he just wanted a state, Herzl acquiesced. He said, fine, Rav Reines, you want to be in charge, no problem. But Weizmann, who is there and who's now a staunch advocate of the type of Zionism of Achat Ha'am, comes to this Zionist Congress, and he's fuming. So with that hakdama, resource number four. If the rabbis come as representatives of the people, we welcome them, right? He's talking to Rav Reines and the other Mizrachinikim. All right, but if they come as representatives of the people, we welcome them. Second line. But if they come as representatives of the synagogues, then it's anti-Jewish, for there is no synagogue in Judaism. Okay? What did he mean by that? He didn't mean that there was no synagogue in Judaism, but he thought that religion is supposed to be individualistic, and the synagogue is for anybody that wants to go there. The synagogue does not rule Judaism. All right. This was speaking like a typical assimilated Jew, right? And by this point, he very much was after his years in Berlin, and he wasn't speaking about the synagogue as being backwards. He had no problem with rabbis. What he had a problem with was rabbis getting up and speaking, religious Jews, Mizrahi Jews getting up and speaking on behalf of all Jews, and certainly on behalf of all Zionists. Second paragraph: the cultural question must and will be the vital nerve of this sinew. I request, therefore, adoption of the motion, which has already been introduced into the Cultural Commission, to initiate regular cultural activity. All right? Regular cultural activity, meaning outside of the Mizrahi Jewish education program. I do not acquiesce to having the word religious inserted into our program. The moment you do this, you exclude a great part of the delegates from our Congress. So he was saying, Herzl was of the mind that nobody's going to care about your learning and your educational platform anyway. If you guys want to be in charge of it, gesunte hey. That was Herzl's attitude. Weizmann was coming along and saying, no, Herzl, what are you talking about? There's a whole faction of Zionists who very much passionately believe in the cultural education that's going to happen in this state, in this program, and who are you to tell me that I have to follow the Mizrahi program? So he's fuming about this. Now, why is this is important? Because the first centralized Zionist activity that Herzl does is following this Congress. Following the fourth Zionist Congress, here's a whole bunch of people that gather around Weizmann, and are fuming at, because these are all ideological students of Achat Ha'am, they're fuming at this idea that the Mizrahi wants to take over the educational component of the state, of the Zionist goals, I should say. We're decades before we were even talking about a state.
What is cultural education? Like, what was it that he said was...
Jewish literature, talking about...
Close on Yom Tov, the post office?
No. It's not... Cultural education means... I mean, I guess the simple way is you got to read the Haskalah literature. Read somebody like Chaim Nachum Bialik. Read somebody like Achat Ha'am. Somebody who speaks about a Jewish soul. Somebody who speaks about a Jewish... Jewish ideals. Jewish ideals not about putting on tefillin every day, not about lighting Shabbos candles, but Jewish ideals in terms of establishing a Jewish community, being proud of the fact that you're Jewish, talking about Jewish history, talking about Jewish theology, talking about Jewish thought, but not Jewish, you know, religious behavior, Jewish religious practice. So, again, to us who are so hardwired into the idea that those two are hainuach, right? The Jewish culture stems from Jewish ideology stems from Jewish practice and Jewish law. So it seems a little strange, but this was a very, very popular mode of thought at this period in Jewish history. So Herzl didn't care. Herzl didn't think that there should be any... Herzl was a completely assimilated Jew. When he started in his program, he barely knew... He barely knew Hebrew. He was he had a grandfather who was a Zionist. We actually spoke about that last year, but very, very little. He was more assimilated than any of the people that we've been talking about. Asher Tzvi Ginzburg grew up in a religious home. Leo Mutzing grew up in a religious home. All these people grew up in religious homes. Herzl was like Jabotinsky, except for the fact that minus the religious upbringing, he didn't have the observant mother. So Herzl didn't care about Jewish ethos. He didn't care about Jewish. He was already a completely assimilated journalist and playwright. Okay, so this is this group of people, these young Zionists, and this is a theme throughout the history of Zionism in the 20th century, how much of this was driven by young people. It's really, really remarkable. This is a delegate card, by the way. I found some of these online. It's super cool. This is a delegate card from the Fourth Zionist Congress. Everybody who had one, you would pay, basically, in order to get into the Zionist Congress, you have to pay an entrance fee. It was actually what they called a shekel, long before there was, alright, a shekel chadash in the land of Israel, in Medina Israel. The shekel was an entrance fee. It was the equivalent to 1 franc or something like that. And then you would get a delegate card with your name on it. So this was the delegate card for the Fourth Zionist Congress. I found a website that actually has all of the delegate cards, and the way they decorated them is fascinating. And you could do a whole study just on the delegate cards about the types of things that they decorated. You'll see, I have the one from the Sixth Zionist Congress on the next page. You'll see what it looks like. Okay, just look at the picture. It's a Jew sitting on a rock in a shtreimel and a kapata, right? If you want to talk about the number, the sheer percentages of people that were not religious, which completely secularized in this movement, the image of the Jew is still there. Okay, so people gather around Weizmann after this, and they form this young Zionist opposition party. It actually becomes the first formalized opposition party within Zionism. There ends up being a bunch of them. And he ends up teaming up with some pretty famous people. People like Martin Buber, people like Mutzkin, and again, as their ideological head, they have Achad Ha'am, so who are very famous, some very famous names. They have a conference and establish a new movement, a new political party, that they call the Democratic Zionist Party. And their goal was to basically carry out Achad Ha'am's mission of fostering a cultural component of the Zionist stream, this cultural component of the new state, rather than solely the political. 1901, Weizmann actually meets with Herzl. Why does he meet with Herzl? Because Herzl apparently is now fuming. The only thing that Herzl wants to do is for the Zionist business to work out. He devotes his life, and in the end, he dies very, very young. He dies in his 40s because he spends his life and his entire family's fortune running around Europe like a mashugana trying to get a Zionist charter. He tries to get foreign governments to buy into this idea of the Jews starting a national home in the land, in Ottoman Palestine. He meets with the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. He meets with Kaiser Wilhelm. He meets with all these big dignitaries, and it all amounts to nothing. And the only thing that Herzl has going for him is the fact that there is a perception that Jewish thought, Jewish opinion is united around this idea. And the minute that he gets a whiff of opposition, Herzl is fuming. Fuming, fuming, fuming. And that's what happens with Weizmann. Herzl says, Mizrahi, you want to take over the cultural aspects of the Zionist ideology? Go ahead. And Weizmann goes nuts, and then Herzl gets upset. So he actually does sit down and meet Herzl, and he writes in his memoirs that leading up to this thing, you see he's like just sittering. He was getting all upset, getting ready to just let loose on Herzl. And they end up having a very congenial and pleasant conversation. He actually I'm not sure. I think it was Achad Ha'am. No, I'm sorry. He brings Buber with him. He brings Martin Buber with him. I should have put a picture of Buber. But Buber is another one of those household names. He was, again, one of these people from the early 20th century. It was a Zionist thinker that was a theologian and an author and an essayist. So we know who Buber is. Okay, so they established this new group, and now they're in the opposition. They meet with Herzl. Herzl actually sanctions it, and he sanctions the movement, the Democratic Zionists. And Herzl, I don't know how sincere he was being, whether or not he believed in what they were saying, whether or not he was just trying to make sure that there was no opposition. But he said, okay, fine, I now buy into this idea that there's going to be a secular version of Jewish education, and the Mizrahi are not going to have sole responsibility for it. Again, at this point, Herzl doesn't care. Anything that's going to get this Zionist movement kickstarted is important. Okay, so after that point, after 1901, 1902, they take a break for a year because Herzl is so unsuccessful in achieving his goal of getting a Zionist charter. 1902, they do not have a 1901, they have the Fifth Zionist Congress. Okay, it was 1902. That they skipped 2 years for the sixth. Okay, so in August of 1901, the Fifth Zionist Congress convenes in Basel, and after Weizmann has now formed this new group of the Democratic Zionists, they send a group of 37 delegates to give you a sense of how big this is. 37 delegates to get Herzl to adopt a mandate that calls for education of the Jewish people in a national spirit. All right, just to answer your question, Joy, in a national spirit as a central part of the Zionist program. All right, what does that mean? Again, we can talk at more length about it another time. He includes as part of the Democratic platform the goal of establishing a Jewish university to rejuvenate Jewish culture. And this is a goal that Weizmann, that consumes him for the next 2 years. This idea of founding a Jewish university. That goal ends up becoming, he had an early role in the founding of the Technion, but the real goal that he had set at this early stage is what would become the Hebrew University. And in 1918, in the middle of World War I, he actually is there as a representative of the British government, and he attends the cornerstone laying of the Hebrew University, because this was his dream for many, many years. Okay, 1903. So what happens in 1903? Herzl, they take a year off after the Fifth Zionist Congress. Oh, let me just read this letter. Weizmann Tacharam, source number 5. I only joined the Cultural Committee at the Fifth Zionist Congress to tackle this problem, this issue of culture. I think that there must be two institutions from the start. One in Palestine, he's talking about the university. One in Palestine, devoted especially to Jewish learning, and another in Europe, a general university with a technical faculty, and of course, a chair of Jewish studies. It will be synthesis of Yavne and Europe. Think about the terminology that he's using. He's talking about Yavne, the Beis Medrash, the yeshiva of Yochanan Zakkai in Eretz Yisrael from 2,000 years earlier. That's still his reference point. The idea of a Jewish center of academia feels like Yavne to him. So again, you as much as these people would say that they were secularists, it was such a part of the Jewish history, and even the Jewish religious history is such an important part of who they were. Okay, as we spoke about in the last couple of weeks, the Kishinev pogrom happens in late April 1903, shocks the Jewish and the Zionist world, and that's when things get real, right, to use our modern vernacular. That's when things become very, very urgent. The exigency with which they needed to do something about, that everybody felt that now Russian Jewry is doomed, and there are 3.2 million Jews that are living in the Pale of Settlement. What are we going to do about it? So in August, a few months after the Kishinev pogrom, the Sixth Zionist Congress convenes. Again, they're back in Basel, and again, this is the delegate card for the Sixth Zionist Congress. They meet, and that's when Herzl, as we spoke about last week, that's when Herzl presents the Uganda program, the Uganda plan. That was land in East Africa that was offered to them by the British government, and this was Herzl's first real big victory. Right? Again, we spoke about it last week. We thought they were going to the Zionist Congress to do the El Arish plan, but the El Arish plan fell through, and then he presents this Uganda plan. Again, the vote that was being voted on was not whether or not to acquiesce to the Uganda plan, but was whether or not to send representatives on a fact-finding mission to East Africa to take a look at this territory, whether or not it was suitable for, as Herzl said at the time, temporary Jewish settlement, because they looked at the Kishinev pogrom, and they said, there's 3 million Jews that are going to be led like lambs to the slaughter. What are we going to do about it? The only thing, it's something that needs to be done now. So he presents this, and as we spoke about last week, there's turmoil that breaks loose. Everybody's furious. And one of the people that was one of the leaders of that turmoil, and we actually spoke about this early on, or 2 weeks ago, one of the leaders of it was, one of the followers, at least, in it was Jabotinsky. And another one of the leaders of it was Weizmann. Okay, by this point, Weizmann was a decorated, tenured university professor. A pretty well-known guy. He was a public intellectual. He was an academic, and he was also a staunch Zionist and an outspoken one for many years. He was fuming at the idea of the Uganda plan. Okay, so let's very quickly just skip through a couple of things, because I want to get to the World War I and the Balfour Declaration. So in 1904, he begins to complete his university work in Geneva. And he had an office in Geneva for the Democratic Zionists. The party basically ends up collapsing. As a result of Kishinev, nobody really cared about culture anymore. This is an important moment in the Zionist program. Nobody really cared about culture anymore, because really now the only goal was to just save Jews. And the ideology of the state, everybody would say, we can leave that for later. Right now, everybody just needs to unite around the idea. So because of that, the whole Democratic Zionist platform was about cultural Zionism. They didn't really have a following like they did before, and the office ends up closing. And that's the point. On July 6th, he leaves Geneva 3 days after Herzl's death. He actually talks about how earth-shattering it was for him, how powerful it was for him. I always, when my grandmother described to me what it was like for my grandmother, Alei HaShalom, before she died, I asked her what it was like when FDR died. And she told me she was bawling. And When I read about Herzl, I'm the people that lived in that lived in that era in the 40s and grew up with my grandmother came as a 10-year-old, and a couple years after she came to the U.S., FDR was elected, and 3 years after they came, FDR was elected, and her entire upbringing, he was the president. So somebody that had that that place in terms of leadership. To lose somebody like that was very, very difficult, very traumatic for her. And she told me she was bawling, and she was not unique. So that's kind of how I picture what it was like for Jews who bought into the Zionist ideology when Herzl died. Suddenly, he was a young man. He was in his 40s. Nobody expected it to happen. So he was heartbroken when Herzl died. 3 days later, as was his plan originally, he leaves Geneva. And he moves to Britain. He moves to London, and he gets a job on one of his Zionist trips in 1904. The 1904 Congress that happens in the Congress that happens in 1901 in London. He actually makes some contacts, and he eventually gets a job offer in Manchester University in London. So he takes the job and he moves to London. And this is a very critical point for us, because that's when he moves from Switzerland to Britain, and that's when he becomes part of the Jewish community in Britain, in London, and it's part of, and because of his position in the university, and because he's a very popular and very accomplished and very, very skilled chemist, he ends up being placed exactly where he needs to be in terms of his Zionist activism as well. So 1904, in July, he goes. In January of 1906, Weiss meets with Arthur James Balfour, leader of the Conservative Party, to explain to him why Jews opposed the East Africa Territory Plan. And that's the source number six. So he calls him in because the reason why he got this meeting is because he knew important Jews, and because there were many Jews already at that point in history. There were actually Jews that were in the cabinet in London, in His Majesty's government in 1904. So James Arthur Balfour, who actually was what we would call today a Christian Zionist, he was a Bible believing Christian. He didn't understand why, based on what he understood of the Zionists, he didn't understand why they didn't go for the East Africa plan. So he calls in. He wants to meet with Weizmann. This is actually on the eve of the election, and he was a politician, Balfour, and he probably was concerned about the vote. So he meets with him. Source number six. I began to sweat blood. This is him in his memoirs describing his 1906 meeting with Balfour. I began to sweat blood to make my meaning clear through my English. He spoke a broken English at this point. At the very end, I made an effort. I had an idea. I said, Mr. Balfour, if you were offered Paris instead of London, he asked, why is it that you didn't like East Africa? If you were offered Paris instead of London, he looked surprised. Would you take it? Would you take Paris instead of London? He looked surprised. But London is our own, I said. But London is our own. I said, Jerusalem was our own when London was a marsh. He leaned back, continued to stare at me, and said two things, which I remember vividly. He's recalling this decades later. The first was, are there many Jews who think like you? I answered, I believe I speak the mind of millions of Jews whom you will never see and who cannot speak for themselves, but with whom I could pave the streets of the country I come from. To this he said, if this is so, you will one day be a force. And he's spoken like a true politician. If you're really as united as you say you are, this is who eventually becomes the prime minister, and then 10 years later is the foreign secretary and the author of the Balfour Declaration. So, he says, I believe you won't be a force. Shortly, or second to last line, shortly before I withdrew, Balfour said, it is curious. The Jews I meet are quite different. I answered, Mr. Balfour, you meet the wrong kinds of Jews. Okay? So this is Weizmann, who had not a small amount of chutzpah to him. This is talking to somebody who's about to be the prime minister. but already from this meeting, Balfour and Weizmann, as was the case throughout his political activity, Balfour and Weizmann hit it off, and they really, really like each other. And that ends up playing a really important role a few years down the line. Okay, 1907, in September, he visits Ottoman Palestine for the first time, talks about it in a very, very flowery way. Source number six, I traveled by boat from Beirut to Jaffa. This is, he gets married in 1906. We skipped that point. But that's Weizmann with his wife Vera, who was a piece of work unto herself, We don't have time to talk about it. We're out of time now anyway. So let's just finish this up. I traveled source number six. I traveled my boat from Beirut to Jaffa. My feet stepped on the land that had been since the days of my childhood, an inseparable part of my thoughts. He's a Zionist since he's a little kid, and he's being there for the first time as an adult in 1907. Finally, I was face to face with reality. I came to the firm decision that I should return to Europe and continue to increase the pressure with double the energies for urgent practical work in Palestine. Right? Practical work. He wants to build up settlements. He wants to build up land, Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. Okay, so this is his first impression in 1907. He talks in a bunch of other letters and in his memoirs about seeing these settlements that Chovevei Tzion had established, that with foreign tzedakah were being established, and it just blows him away, and he really does believe more than ever that in the Zionist dream. Okay, so that's 1907. We're going to, obviously, by the end here, knowing that I want everybody to get a sense of where he was coming from and how he got started, the same way that I did with Ben-Gurion, how he got started in Zionist activity. This is a part of him his entire life. 1910, he finally receives British citizenship. 1914, right, obviously, we're skipping. There was a lot of stuff. There's 100 pages in the biography on these years. July of 1914, the summer, World War I breaks out. Weizmann, among others, sees this as an opportunity for the British liberating Palestine from the Ottoman Empire, and the greatest opportunity that there possibly ever will be for establishing a Jewish homeland in the newly conquered British Palestine. And he starts lobbying, because he is who he is, has the connections that he does, he starts lobbying really from the beginning of the war. In addition, he does something else in the war. In 1950, he immediately starts to go to work, and this has happened in World War II also. I've seen movies in World War II, not as many in World War I, but I've read books, seen movies about these stories about how in Great Britain, and we did it here with the Manhattan Project. That's my American example. But they would actually turn all the scientists into soldiers. They were part of the war effort. The same way World War II, everybody was part of the war effort in one way or another. So the scientists were drafted into developing scientific research. World War I, which we spoke a little bit about last week, was unique in the fact that because of the technology that was being introduced to the world, tanks, aircraft, these types of things that, you know, armored cars, big, giant weapons that can kill multiple people at once, right? Only a few years earlier, we were still using bayonets. And now we were talking about this massive weaponry. 9 million people die in World War I. To that point in human history, compared to World War II, it's a drop in the bucket. It's a fraction of World War II. But until that point in human history, it dwarfs any other war by far. And that was after about a century of relative peace since the Napoleonic Wars of the 19th century. So World War I is completely devastating. During that time, Weizmann gets drafted into working for the British Army to develop chemical weapons, and he invents a new method for producing acetone, a solution that was essential for the production of explosive materials, not just chemical weapons, but also explosives as well. Weizmann moves to London, and because he makes this discovery, he invents this particular substance, he becomes a leading advisor on weaponry, which means he's in the room with all the most important people in the British government during World War I. All right. Lucky for us, he also happens to have a secondary goal. In addition to winning the war, he also happens to have the secondary goal of Zionism. So, in 1915, he invents this stuff for acetone, and he becomes an advisor to the British Admiralty and Ministry of Munitions for the supply of acetone. Okay, so he's in the room with all these important people. 1916 in December, Lloyd George succeeds Herbert Henry Asquith. Asquith was very hostile to the Zionists in the years that he was prime minister. In the middle of, basically what happened in the middle of the war was, in the first couple of months, there was a lot of action in the front lines, and then, basically, all of the armies dug in, and there was all this trench warfare in which everybody was just shooting at each other and killing each other during World War I, and everything was a stalemate. There was no movement from either side, and everybody was furious with the current government. We can't make peace with these with the Central Powers, you know, the British citizens were saying, and we can't. For some reason, we're not going on any type of offensive in defeating them. What is this government doing? So they actually voted out Asquith and brought in the conservative government. And this is not, you know, uncommon in terms of voting patterns during wartime. They voted in the conservative government, and that's when they voted Lloyd George as the new prime minister. And Lloyd George appoints our very own Arthur Balfour as his foreign secretary, right? The British version of the equivalent of the Secretary of State, the person in charge of foreign state, foreign issues with foreign states and diplomacy. So Now we have these people. So you have Balfour, whom Weizmann already knows from 10 years prior, from when they met and liked each other, and made a very deep impression on Balfour about Zionism. And you have Lloyd George, who is another Bible-believing Christian, who is what we would call a Christian Zionist. He very much sympathized with the Zionist cause. So they get voted in 1916, and shortly thereafter, Weizmann meets them. Again, this is December of 1916. Within a couple of weeks, Weizmann is in the room meeting with both Balfour and Lloyd George to lobby for not just Zionism generally, but specifically a declaration on the part of the British government, post the Great War, when the war is finally over, that it should be a recognized national homeland in Palestine for the Jewish people. That's the first seeds of the Balfour Declaration, and they like the idea. They're both of them are very sympathetic to Zionism, and they start to work on this. So in 1917, it becomes the president of the British Zionist Federation, an organization that was established after Britain conquers Palestine from Ottoman rule, and he conducts negotiations with the British government, again, that started in late 1916 when they took over in December for the Balfour Declaration, which eventually culminates in the Balfour Declaration. Okay. So let's just take a quick look over here. The Balfour Declaration, we don't have time to get into it. But the Balfour Declaration is one of history's more interesting developments. What was it? What was its legal status? What was its purpose? Who was it written to? Who was it written for? To what extent was Britain actually obligating itself in something? So, and it's very interesting because this wasn't a voted on piece of legislation. This was a declaration by the Foreign Secretary, Lord Balfour, to not even the Zionist Committee. He writes it to Lord Rothschild, who is a leading, lay person. He was a very wealthy Jew. He writes it to Lord Rothschild and asks him to convey. So take a look at I have the original scan of the Balfour Declaration on the top of page 4. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. Okay, so this was not voted on by the House of Lords or the House of Commons. This was just discussed in the Cabinet, and the Cabinet approves this text. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Okay, so that's a very long run-on sentence, and it's saying a lot of things. And I was hoping to have time to get into it, and we're not going to. But I have over here, this is actually, I pulled this off of Wikipedia, but this is, I read about this, but this is very convenient, this chart. This was the multiple drafts of the Balfour Declaration that went into it. I went into what was eventually the final draft. The first draft was actually submitted by the Zionist executive, by Weizmann and the rest of the office, of what they would like the declaration to say. In the end, what did the declaration say? It was a lot of toned down language so as to leave room for ambiguity. His Majesty's government view with favor. What does that mean, view with favor? Does that mean endorsing? Does that mean obligating ourselves to? Or does it just mean, the same way that I like chocolate popsicles, I also like the idea of a Jewish state, of a Jewish nation, right? Of whatever this is. I like what I'm about to say. So, again, it leaves room for interpretation. So what was it that they view with favor? The establishment in Palestine, all right? Not the establishment of Palestine. Again, you look at the original draft. But the establishment in Palestine, no boundaries, doesn't say how big or how small. The establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Okay? What is a national home? Is a national home a state? Again, it's not just a home, it's a national home, so it seems to have some sort of political significance, but again, it's not a state for the Jewish people, it's not a Jewish state. So again, another ambiguity. And we'll use their best endeavors. What is best endeavors? Are we going to commit military force? Are we going to commit financially? Are we going to commit governmentally? What is it that we're willing to do? Their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, right? And this was a bone that they were throwing to the Arabs, who were lobbied very, very vociferously against the Balfour Declaration, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That was a bone that they threw to the reformists, who also lobbied against the Balfour Declaration, the reformed Jews who didn't believe in Zionism, right? To the non-Zionist Jews. Okay, so The Balfour Declaration had a huge, huge, huge effect. Until the 1939 white paper that essentially revoked the the Balfour Declaration. So the November 2nd was actually celebrated the same way that we celebrate Yom HaTzmaut. It was celebrated in Zionist circles as a holiday every single year. The Balfour Declaration was essential because this is the first time, and again, this is fascinating, really, 20 years after Herzl first convened the first Zionist Congress, the most powerful nation in the world was recognizing the aspirations of the Jewish people and saying that they were committing themselves to it. So Weizmann played a direct role in this, not just because of his personal charm, but because he kept to his guns as a chemist and actually was able to be a productive member of society so that he was in the room with all these important people. Okay, there's so much more that happens in the aftermath of the Balfour Declaration, but as soon as Britain takes over, they actually do, in the early stages to some extent, remain committed to this ideal. The immigration in the early years of the British mandate are in the tens of thousands every single year. Right? When we get into bad pogroms, and when we get into a lot of Jewish violence leading into the 20s and 1930s, then those numbers end up getting amped up. But they do actually support this. And by the time the white paper comes out in 1939, they facilitated the immigration of about 500,000 Jews. So that's not the 3 million that Weizmann had in mind, but 500,000 Jews is still a big deal. I'm going to mention one thing because it was actually the Paris Peace Conference, which actually happens at the end of World War I. Weizmann is now a part of the delegation of the British government representing the Zionists. So powerful, so high was the status of the Zionists at this point, at the end of World War I, that they actually had seats in the Paris Peace Conference. The type of thing that, it's like hard to imagine, but Zionism really did hit its peak. It hit its zenith in the mid-World War I period, and I just don't see how Weizmann is not the one solely responsible for that. We talked about how Jabotinsky and his activism in terms of forming the Jewish Legion was essential as well, and I don't think I can't imagine that they didn't play an important role in terms of pro-Zionist sentiments among the British government. But at the same time, he was the one that he developed bombs, and they owed a personal debt to him, and that was actually a big part of what the Balfour Declaration was. Okay, so one last point. I didn't put it on here, but in the wake of the Balfour Declaration, Weizmann was not just, he didn't go back to his lab, he continued to be for decades a central Zionist leader. He sometimes clashed with Ben-Gurion, sometimes they got along. In general, the end of it here is a picture of, towards the end of his career, of Ben-Gurion and Weizmann. And I think this is it's too early, Ben-Gurion's not old enough. So, I think it's the early 1940s. So, he becomes an essential figure. He becomes part of the diplomatic process of implementing, immediately after the war, the plan for the Balfour Declaration. And that includes what to date, and it's really just fascinating when you hear this little piece of history. I want everybody to go home and Google the Faisal-Weizmann agreement. He actually meets with Faisal ibn Ali, who was then the royal leader of Syria, and says for the first time, this is in 1919, after they meet in the Paris Peace Conference, and they actually reach a signed accord, saying that we the Jewish community, the Jewish people, are going to recognize Arab, none of the Arab states are around yet here. We are going to recognize Arab rights for the X, Y, and Z countries, forming these countries, and we're going to recognize your sovereignty in exchange for your recognition of ours. And the flowery language between these two statesmen of how we recognize your aspirations. It's important. So the Arabs were talking about this. And it was all contingent on the British guaranteeing the Arab statehood that they had promised. And that Arab statehood did eventually happen, but it didn't happen for several years after. And because of that, the mob, whom Faisal actually referred to as the peasants of Palestine, right? He didn't even, the idea of Palestinians and Palestinian nationalism didn't exist back then. He would refer to them as the simple peasants, the people that are rioting. He would talk about them as being the people that are, as dismissing them. But the fact that Britain didn't implement the Arab states in a timely fashion, that actually opened the window for a lot of fomenting a lot of anti-Zionistic sentiment within the Arab world, and that led to all of the riots that happened, which, because of all of these anti-Zionist, anti-Jewish movements in the Arab world during the 20s and 30s, that's what kept, basically, pushed the British into a corner, into curtailing Jewish immigration into the land of Israel. So because of all of that, The Balfour Declaration never reached its full fruition as they had planned. We spoke about last week about how Jabotinsky had viewed the Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations mandate. We're not going to talk about that right now, but just I guess what I wanted to emphasize today is the role, the early life and understanding who Chaim Weizmann was and where he came from, but also the role, the essential role that he played at this stage in Jewish history. And without him, like I said, if he's not number one, he's one or two or three, because without him, the Balfour Declaration doesn't happen. Without the Balfour Declaration, who knows what would have happened. So we should all just have a newfound appreciation for who Chaim Weizmann was and the contributions that he made in his lifetime that continue to reverberate today. I thank you all very much. Thank you so much. Have a good day.